The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. In 2008, we had the good fortune to host Lucille Clifton at the library over the course of an entire day. So when I learned that New York Review Books was re-releasing her memoir, Generations, with an introduction by Tracy K. Smith, I jumped at the opportunity to host an event. For those of you who don't know Clifton's work, she spent her career chronicling the African-American female experience and family life through 14 celebrated books of poetry. Her collection, Blessing the Boats, won the National Book Award, and I believe she is still the only author ever to have two books of poetry nominated in the same year for the Pulitzer Prize. Clifton was awarded the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize and the Robert Frost Medal for Lifetime Achievement. She also wrote many books for children and served as the Poet Laureate of Maryland. Continuing the Laureate theme, we're joined tonight by Tracy K. Smith, a former two-term U.S. Poet Laureate and Professor of English and African and African-American Studies at Harvard University. She is also a Chancellor of the American Academy of Poets and the author of five books of verse, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Life on Mars, as well as the memoir Ordinary Light, and her most recent volume, Such Color. She'll be in conversation with Tripita B. Mason, Philadelphia Poet Laureate, and the author of She Was Once Herself and Mocha Melodies. Tracy, Tripita, thank you for joining us. The screen is yours.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here. And Tracy, I'm honored. It's a pleasure to meet you. This is actually our second meeting. A few years back, when we were still gathering in person a lot more, I attended a reading of your poetry book at the Free Library of Philadelphia, Wade in the Water. I actually, one of the poems, the title poem, Wade in the Water, is one of my favorites about love, love, love. Just a beautiful poem. A kind friend gave me an invitation to attend a pre-reading dinner with you, and you were so gracious and generous with your time. You're a writer you're quite busy, but yet you're so accessible to many of us, both through your work and your willingness to share poetry in so many forms with the public. So I want to congratulate you on your many accomplishments and thank you for your stewardship of this great art form.
Oh, that's so kind of you. Thank you. And thank you for your amazing stewardship of poetry. And the role that you're in as Philadelphia's Poet Laureate. And also just the work that you do. I've read your writing on Clifton, and I feel like I've gained new insight into her through that. And so it's exciting that in some ways we're building a big thing together. That's what I think we're doing.
I was just thinking that. I said, you know, we're meeting again. We're going to have a sisterly conversation about our beloved Lucille Clifton. And I say our because so many of us claim her, right? And so many of us need her. And my hope that in the next hour will allow us to not only discuss this memoir, Generations, and this rich themes, but also celebrate our love of Sister Lucille. So tonight, Tracy and I will discuss the themes in Generations, the memoir, and we're going to share through our discussion lines and passages to highlight the great life of Lucille Clifton and this memoir of her family. But to begin, Tracy's going to read the introductions to Generation, and then we're going to share that now.
I guess I'll just preface this by saying, you know, the honor and the opportunity to provide an introduction to Clifton's work was so huge and wonderful. And then I realized, oh my goodness, there are so many ways that this book can be framed. Mm-hmm. What path do I want to carve in? And so this is what came to me.
Beautiful.
What is our relationship to history? Do we belong to it or is it ours? Are we in it Does it run through us, spilling out like blood? Sorry, spilling out like water or blood? I think the answers to those questions, at least in America, depend upon who you are, or rather, on who you've been taught to believe that you are. If the history you descend from has been mapped, adapted, mythologized, reenacted, and broadcast as though it is the central defining story of a continent, perhaps you can be forgiven, up to a point, for having succumbed to a collective distortion. But what if yours is a history the wider world once recorded, not as lives and feats, but as articles of inventory? Men, women, children, listed according to their age and value as property. What if the largeness of those lives, what they endured, yes, but also what they carried, remembered, witnessed, and made, has been hushed up, negated, overwritten, or outright erased? What if the recovery of your full story sheds stark light on the lie of that other, louder story? There it is, light. It took three paragraphs to creep in as a metaphor, though it runs through the work of Lucille Clifton like life force. Light comes to her, light speaks, light emanates from the figures of history and myth, like Lucifer, God's bringer of light, whom Clifton claims as her namesake, and who, in her rendering, testifies, "Illuminate I could, and so illuminate I did." If light is what the work of Clifton is intent upon spreading, then I'm tempted to think that history, as we have been conditioned to accept it, is unrefracted, all of a piece, and blindingly white. Whereas Clifton's imagination is prismatic. It slows down the central story so we can see what it is truly made of, all the dazzling colors moving at different frequencies and, depending upon circumstances, in distinct directions. In Generations, her poetically terse and emotionally epic prose memoir, first published in 1976, Clifton uses the occasion of her father's funeral to attest to the lives lived and the marks made by the generations of people she descends from. First, they are names, dates, and places, like Caroline Donald, Mammy Caroline, born free among the Dahomey people in 1822 and died free in Bedford, Virginia in 1910. To reinscribe these lives into recollected history is to restore history itself to a rightful state of commotion. Once named, these kin arrive not singly but en masse, brought to life through the rhythm and inflection of voices, like the voice of Clifton's own father, Sam Sayles, in whose vernacular rhythm Mammy Caroline is not merely described, but rather conjured. This is his voice. "Oh, she was tall and skinny and walked straight as a soldier, Lou, straight like somebody marching wherever she went. And she talked with an Oxford accent. I ain't kidding. Don't let nobody tell you them old people was dumb. She talked like she was from London, England. And when we kids would be running and hooping and hollering all around, she would come to the door and look straight at me and shake her finger and say, 'Stop that bedlam, mister. Stop that bedlam, I say,' with an Oxford accent, Lou. She was a dark, old, skinny lady, and she raised my daddy and then raised me, at least till I was 8 years old, when she died." I hear in Sales his O's and his Lou's and his exclamations and his insistence, something that is not simply expressive, but exultant and positively oracular. He is engaged not simply in an act of telling, but of creating and consecrating a capacity for belief and understanding in both his daughter and, if we're listening properly, his daughter's readers. The passage above segues seamlessly into the following capacity-expanding moment, when Clifton's father signifies upon how, at 8 years of age, Mammy Caroline walked north from New Orleans to Virginia in 1830, at which point she was sold away from her family. And this is Sam Sayles again. I remember everything she ever told me. Because you know, when you're that age, you're old enough to remember things. I remember everything she told me, Lou, even though she died when I was 8 years old. And then I knowed about what she remembered, because that's how old she was when she got here, 8 years old. Mammy Caroline's depth of feeling, knowledge, and loss, in other words, the reality of her personhood, both affirmed and was affirmed by the reality of young Sam Sayles's selfhood. As a child in grief, he found depth of feeling and knowledge, or generated it, through belief in what Mammy Caroline, in her own grief, would have been required to find or generate. These are the lives that America's dominant history, as defined by aspirational notions of white personhood, has let fall into shadow. These are the stories that have been left unmarked and untended by America's preferred view of itself, like the graves of slaves on land passed down through the white generations. One of the major contributions of Clifton's writing is that she has teased out these lives, allowing them to demand their rightful space, to command our full attention, to teach us things about themselves and ourselves. But it is not enough only to tease out, to separate and disband. Clifton's purpose is to teach us to see what we are in fact moving together and what we are in fact, sorry, that we are moving together and that we are in fact part of a large whole. If that whole is unified, unity is not what we have been taught to believe. It is not compliance, not assimilation, not an enforced hierarchy. Neither is it simply escape. What then is the vision of America that Clifton is intent upon illuminating? When you arrange one prism next to another, all those different colors, red, orange, yellow, and so on, rejoin one another. And together, they begin to move in another direction. There's one more thing I want to ask you to consider as you lose and perhaps find yourself in the generations of Clifton's family. I take as significant the fact that Walt Whitman's voice is invoked alongside the everyday poetry taken from the mouths of Clifton's ancestors. In this context, Whitman's Song of Myself is no longer a familiar American music, but an invitation to a radical reconfiguring of self. In other words, when Whitman's I celebrate myself and sing myself and what I assume you shall assume for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you is sat beneath a portrait of Clifton's grandfather and great-grandmother. What I am made to understand is this. Here in America, and perhaps everywhere, no matter who we have been made to believe that we are, all of us, the children of slaves.
How lovely. Thank you, Tracy.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to begin by saying this is just lovely, and to be able to just lay out the themes that are covered in this wonderful memoir. So in Generations, Lucille Clifton ponders if some of the stories she's heard about her own family are true, particularly of Lucy, the great-grandmother that her father tells her was hanged for killing a white man. And in page 38 to 39, she writes, later, I would ask my father for proof. Where are the records, Daddy? I would ask. The time may not be right, and it may just be a family legend or something. Somebody somewhere knows, he would say, and I would be dissatisfied and fuss with Fred about fact and proof and history until he told me one day not to worry, that even the lies are true. In history, even the lies are true. So Tracy, you began your introduction by asking, what is our relationship to history? Do we belong to it or is it ours? Does it run through us spilling like water of blood? So powerful. Let's talk about that. What do you feel our relationship with history in context of this story or just in general? And I love this idea of spilling like water or blood.
Well, you know, this story makes me aware of the different relationships that each of us has, right? And so one is what we imagine is collective, what's shaped by the central story. And I believe in America, it's a central white story, a story that centers whiteness, and that, you know, necessarily has to downplay some of the things that call whiteness into question. I think that allegiance to what is official is what made, you know, young Lucille Clifton say, are there facts that can be corroborated from this, the story you're telling me? Is this real? Did this happen? And in some ways, that question is not just a symptom of, you know, the notion that there is one history and that it descends from above, but also it reveals how much the quiet, the undocumented, and the lived history of Black people in this country has been discounted, you know, mm-hmm. has been cast as inaccurate, as overly subjective, as if history itself, any account, isn't subjective.
Yes.
And so I love that part of the work of this book is to honor these stories that she had been hearing her whole life, and also to say, not only are they real for me, but if you listen, they allow us to understand how all of these other stories fit together. And if you're willing to take the risk of having something recalibrated, then you can get a better sense of what we belong to, what we've made, damaged, protected, rebuilt, and been marked by. And that's a big gift, I think.
I agree.
Poetry, she also often, you know, justice is important to her. Black lives are of immense importance to her. But there's this vision of after that she also casts, in which all of us are somehow accountable to something bigger than what is human. Mm-hmm. And it's a glorious and terrifying position. You know, there's a poem of hers that ends where we're being asked, why ever did you do this to one another? Why did you do this to yourselves? Mm-hmm. And the poem ends with us humans saying, because. This book helps us to think of other forms of sense making, you know.
Yes. Yeah. And this whole idea of, do we belong to it or is it ours? And in the telling of the stories of her family in this this rich way of telling the story, this is a question that we ponder even as writers. These stories that we tell, does it belong to us? Is it ours or is it something? Because she's really exposing a lot here. There's the history, and then there are also these intimate family stories. She talks about her mother and father, you know, about their intimate relations or not. And sometimes I wonder, as a writer, and the things that we choose to keep and the things that we choose to expose, and this whole idea, these questions you asked in the beginning, who does it really belong to? Is it ours to tell these stories? So what are your thoughts on that?
I think that we live with the feeling that they're ours. Mm-hmm. You know, like that idea, you know, this refrain in Clifton's life, you come from Dahomey women. You mm-hmm. take what you need, you get what you want. Mm-hmm. That helped her, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. I think that the death of her father also allowed her to understand that there's something that we also owe to those lives. Mm-hmm. There's something that we owe to one another, and that we're stewards of something. We're not just beneficiaries of a history and a sense of, you know, either lineage or endurance or capacity. Right. We must tend to this thing that is not yet finished being made.
Mm-hmm. And so, the tending is the telling also.
Yeah, right?
The telling of it. And so that leads me to, I love how you describe in your introduction, how Clifton introduced us to her kin, her family, not individually, but I love the en masse. And it's almost felt like we were just bombarded, or I like to say pleasantly overwhelmed by all of these characters, their lives, the language, the stories, the color, just so brilliantly rendered, so poetic. So I wanted to talk about ancestry and archiving, memory and storytelling. What is critical for you in the telling, and where do you start? And what do you think motivated Clifton? What do you think motivates her in the telling of the story? The Dahomey woman, of course, was one major theme that ran through this story. And I couldn't really decide whether she was placing more emphasis on value on one more than others. But there was this continuation, this buildup about this Dahomey women. And so let's just talk about what's critical in storytelling, and particularly for you, as well as for what you picked up from Lucille Clifton.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love that we get snatches of the voices of different people, mm-hmm. and hearing her father's voice, and even hearing, you know, the great great grandmother, and how she was described. It, I said in my introduction, there's that commotion. It brings the sense of, you know, what I like to think of as the breath, which maybe is my way of saying a not unspent set of energies and wishes, needs, and a kind of life force. So that feels big to me. It feels big also that the way we, and I'm going to put myself in the we of her family in a way, the ways that we have used English as a container for our feelings and experiences, the vernacular that runs through, you know, Black Southern voices and all the different ways that they change regionally and generationally, that feels like a kind of philosophy to me, you know. And there are some lines that you and I have talked about, like you mentioned, even the lies are true, or,
yes,
you know, there's a moment where her great aunt says, it's not over, or she's told slavery was a terrible thing, but it was only ever temporary. And, you know, it's not the way that one would naturally think about the condition of, for some people, lifelong enslavement, but the containers that we make to tell ourselves who we are and who we will be, even if we aren't around to be alive in that we, it feels oracular to me. It feels world creating. It instantly recalibrates the scale, not only of what we're enduring. So that notion that slavery was only ever temporary makes this uncatalogable kind of suffering small in the face of something else that Black life is about that's vast, you know. And that feels miraculous to me. There's a lot. It's the voices that do a lot for me. It's also, you know, and she lists these generations, and it's like a prayer, you know, naming Mammy Caroline, naming the Lucy, naming Sam, naming all of the descendants down to herself. It's I think a way of cementing the reality of these lives, right?
And that's done several times. I think at least twice there's this naming. It felt like a conjuring. Very much so. I found myself repeating these names, and I almost felt like this is how she was doing her praise, or her, as a, you know, a conjuring, giving prayer, giving praise. It just felt more than just words on the page.
Yeah, it wasn't just historical, right?
It wasn't just
the facts and the timeline. It was, you're right, like a calling down into the body. Be here with me. In the way the prayer works, yeah. right? Yeah. Two more gathered together, something descends.
Yeah, it felt necessary. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to, I think you kind of touched on this about the balance and the light in her work. You had mentioned it a little bit. There's a passage about Aunt Lucille, the woman that she's named after, you know, on page 65. And audience members, we are definitely going to get to your questions. But we have a couple of nuggets that we wanted to share with you this evening. So on page 65, as they are putting Fred into, you know, father, I'm sorry, her father's funeral, Aunt Lucille, she says, Aunt Lucille was shaking my arm and crying without shame, quietly and straight as a soldier. Mammy, Mammy, she was whispering in her tears. Mammy, it's 1969 and we're still here. I held her hand tightly, Lucille and Lucille. My father bumped against the earth like a rock. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's 1969 and we're still here. It's 2021 and we're still here. Mm-hmm. You know, the balance just in her work. So let's talk about Lucille Clifton. And I think you and I shared this conversation briefly, but I also saw it in the introduction, this idea of light, hope. And I think as we're talking about storytelling and generations and memoir and that prayer and conjuring we mentioned earlier, and there's the struggle, which you're going to get to with the passage that you're going to read, but there are so many light moments here. Very light moments. The father, you know, brought tears to my eyes when he wrote her a letter when she went to Howard University. And mm-hmm. the dad could not really write. And the mother writing her back to say, he spent all day writing this letter for you. Mm-hmm. And she said, this is the greatest thing I've read my whole life. The greatest mm-hmm. thing I'll ever read. Were those three lines from her father. Talk about light and hope in Clifton's work.
Yeah. I mean, it's a source of casting out the doubt, mm-hmm. right? Even in the biblical sense, mm-hmm. and casting out at even just momentarily the sense of trouble. In this book, the sense of trouble that brings all of this into play is the death of her father. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, there's laughter yes. in the gathering. They laugh on their way. It's actually such a beautiful entry into the journey to the funeral. They're laughing on the road. There's a moment where she and her husband and siblings are being followed by a cowboy who's yes. up on the bumper of their car. And yes. you know, if we saw this in a movie, we'd say, oh no, there's going to be some racial tension here. Well, I'm scared. No, they laugh. They laugh at the cowboy and scare him, you know, off the road in a way, in a joyful, yes. mirthful way. And I think that's a really interesting reversal of something that we have kind of like internalized, the perception of Black life as fraught by risk and danger and constrained by that. Yes. The light here says we're big, we're full of mm-hmm. mirth and life-giving energy and hope, freedom.
Yes.
That feels huge. And it doesn't outshine the presence of other elements, but it does a powerful kind of counterbalancing work. It makes
it really does. It really does. I especially love it when she when she spoke about the woman, you know, as they were, first of all, she talked about Pennsylvania a lot because I was laughing because I'm in Philadelphia and their whole sense of Pennsylvania is not really a fond one. But she spoke about the woman who wanted her, you know, hey, we're not those types of Blacks here. And, you know, she didn't say it, but in her presence, in her look, she was silencing their joy and she was not going to have that. Mm-hmm. You know, they were not going to have that. And there's a page you had mentioned, and we were talking about this whole slavery and, you know, just throughout her story, we're talking about the Dahomey women we're talking about this also a legacy of slavery. And then you mentioned in the introduction and talk about Whitman's poems that's kind of throughout this memoir. So can you, why don't you maybe share a little bit about that passage, and let's just talk about what you were thinking about when you highlighted that.
Yeah, sure. Will you help me out with the page number?
Yes, 27, 28.
Okay. So this is one of the stories. I'm going to just read maybe a half of this paragraph. One of the stories that she grew up hearing. Uncle Louis had been given to, so Lucille Sale was a young, strong, beautiful, proud woman. Mm-hmm. And one day when she had got big, she was in the field and a carriage come by and stopped, and two old men was in it. It was Uncle Louis Sale, and he was a slave, but he was too old to work in the field. And so his job was to drive his master in the carriage. His master was old man John F. Sale, and he was an old man too, Lou, and blind. Uncle Louis had been given to his family as a boy. He was a present to their family. He was somebody, and he was a present, a wedding present, Lou. And he was driving this carriage, an old man driving another old man, and he saw Caroline in the orchard, and he stopped the horses and asked old man John F. to buy her for him, for his wife. And old man John F. did. She was a young lady by then, Lou, and Uncle Louis had been born in 1777, but she was bought and went off to the sale place. And old man John F. married them legal because he was a lawyer, and they always said he was a good man. She lived there on the sale place, and they trained her to be a midwife, and Mammy Caroline and Uncle Louis had seven or more children, Lou. And one of the first ones was a girl. They called her Lucy, but her name was Lucille. Like my own sister and like you. Oh, slavery, slavery, my daddy would say. It ain't something in a book, Lou. Even the good parts was awful. I feel like that's such an important moment because it's full of all these, what I think of as just conundrums, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that this man, this somebody, and that somebody is important also in Clifton's poetry, that phrase, you are somebody, is something that is inside of her, but he's reduced to a gift, a wedding gift, and given to another man his own age. And this young woman was married to this old man without agency, and yet they created something. They made space for other generations to come through. I feel like it sheds light on the not only the cruelty of the institution, which we're used to, but that preposterousness of it, mm-hmm. you know, the many contradictions. Two peers, but one is considered to be the owner of another. One is considered property. And a woman who's strong in her bearing and strong enough to, you know, to make this powerful mark on time and space, reduced to essentially a gift to this other person.
With no choices, right?
Yeah, I mean, we know that, but there's something about the way that it's distilled into a little paragraph that fits into her father's mouth, mm-hmm. that's full of facts and dates and relationships. It's almost like a little work of theater.
Yes.
And when you're given this, when history is familiar, when it's something you can see played out dramatically, and when the facts and the data, it becomes something else. It becomes, I don't know, a form of evidence. Mm-hmm. It becomes, I don't know, an alternate doctrine in a way.
Yes.
And that felt helpful to me. And I feel like there's even a way that the wish for proof that Clifton asked her father for, are there dates? Is this written down? That was familiar to me, that feeling of, can I trust this as not just wishful? And so to receive this story many, many times over mm-hmm. in all of these remembered, you know, moments of listening to her father, and to have it pieced back together, even to have the images of this kin, it felt like it felt like I was finding something for me. Mm-hmm. It felt like my doubts, my anxieties that, you know, the paper trail must end. Therefore, do we exist? Those things that maybe others live with, like I feel like I have, that was dispelled somehow. Mm-hmm. I think that was one of the gifts that I encountered reading this book as a Black person. Mm-hmm. And I imagine the other gift that would come from reading this book as a white person or someone who's not Black would be to see the same dramatic situation played mm-hmm. out and say, my people are here and the reality of their dominion is changed for me.
Right.
Maybe that is also a way of enlarging rather than diminishing something.
Right. And I find that is so awesome, a way to think about that, because what we're really asking is, when you enter into these stories, is to be able to see just as much as effort as Lucille Clifton putting into making her family lives so big, mm-hmm. so colorful, so large, is to also see yourself as the reader in that larger story, you know, and to place yourself there. And I wonder about the storyteller, her father. It's complicated, right? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, we have this gift of all these stories that he told, and I was going along for the ride, and I believe them. I know that she, young Lucille, asked for proof, but you know, I believe all these stories. But there's also a complication, you know, complicated telling of the story. She lays everything to bear. We're able to see it. And for me, I'm curious for you, what did you kind of want to take away from the storyteller, the father? Mm. You know, I saw him as a whole person, and I was okay with the complications. Mm-hmm. And for a part of me was really intent with no judgment. I was grateful for the stories. But especially, you know, when the mother, there's a line in there when the mother said several times, I'm just tired, Lucille. I'm just tired. Mm-hmm. And you just imagine as a woman, as a Black woman, all the things, the years with no intimacy. But then here are these brilliant stories coming from this father. So what did you choose to, where did you place the dad in the storytelling, the father?
Well, I was really grateful for the gift of what he transmitted. Mm-hmm. But I was also grateful for the courage that Clifton had to mm-hmm. also say, this is a man who had lots of women. This is a man who, you know, disappeared sometimes. And then there's also a very quiet form of discretion that she exercises in that book, where she says, it wasn't all good times. Mm-hmm. There were some things that were not good that happened in that house and that man did. Yes. And we understand a little bit of that sometimes from her poetry. There's a lot of darkness in yeah. family. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet it becomes part of this really complicated, large story.
And to think
that hurts in a way that it should hurt.
Yes.
Right? Recovering all of this doesn't fix everything else. It just adds to the fabric in a way. And there's a lot of ache, you know, the mother suffers, the siblings, you know, there's addiction, there's, you know, the sense of lostness, mm-hmm. even among the siblings as they're going back to the funeral. That doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. But this book is about these other things that can be helpful to that if we let them.
Agreed. And it's a small book. It's a quick read, but not really, because that's deceptive, because you're going over these stories over. Mm-hmm. I've read it a couple times.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a celebration. And I think my last question is gonna, or comment I should say, should center around Lucille Clifton, because we have a couple of questions in the chat for you. And as you know, that one poem that we think about, Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life, right? I think you read somewhere how that poem for me is, you know, it's like a mantra. But I read the poem in between reading the generations and reading the book. Mm-hmm. And that's the line that resonated with me, what I have shaped into a kind of life. I had no model, you know, and the, you know, born in Babylon, both non-white and woman. What did I see to be except myself? So all I was thinking about her arriving at Howard with the suitcase, with the makeshift rope around it, and how people perceived her, her see-through blouse and, you know, not a fashionable outfits, and all the times when she was disregarded and not treated, you know, according to the stature of who she is, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I think about her poem, and it makes sense, right? So celebrate this life with me that I've chosen to make into something. Mm-hmm. Right. So what resonates with you with that poem? And I'm selfish here, Tracy, because that's one of my favorite poems, and I don't want to lose this. I don't want to have this opportunity to talk about Lucille Clifton without speaking about that.
You recited so much of it, but is it okay if I just read it?
Of course.
Well? Yes. Maybe not everybody knows it.
Yes, I would love that.
And it's one of her iconic poems. Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman, what did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay, hold my one hand holding tight my other hand. Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
And has failed.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this poem sits on just about every plane of existence that we can really consider, right? I mean, if we're thinking about history, that every day becomes something, is many things. But of course, it also fits inside the frame of a house, of a domestic life, of a body, and the forms of resilience, belief, insistence, creativity, invincibility that are brought to bear in keeping going. It's miraculous.
It is. And what an amazing reading of that too. There are so many questions about that. We have three questions, but while we're on this poem, someone wants to know the name of the poem. So it's called Won't You Celebrate With Me, Lucille Clifton. You can Google that. You can find that poem just about everywhere. It's even been turned into, you know, art pieces and street poetry in different places. Go ahead, Tracy.
I was just going to say, poets have signified upon this poem in so many different ways. Camila Aisha Moon, our wonderful, and now our ancestor, a poet who we lost this fall, has a book by that title, which is signifying on the work and purpose of Clifton and bringing something new to her sense of these stakes. There's one other thing I wanted to say, Tripita. Mm-hmm. It's a slim memoir. Mm-hmm. It is slim in the way that, you know, Christ's words in the Bible are few. Mm-hmm. And there's something that, people have often talked about Clifton's work. Her poems are brief. Many of them are short. Humbly, she would say, well, I have so many children I write when they're asleep.
Yes,
but these
yes.
are poems that come from a genius and a brilliance of, you know, not only poetry, it's not just about art, but it's full of art, but there's something high and eternal in her work. Mm-hmm. She
spiritual
has a lot of,
even.
Yeah,
yes.
spiritual. Yes. And she has a lot of poems that talk about the proximity for her of the spirit realm. Mm-hmm. And so this memoir is like a crystallization or distillation of you know, the epic of Black history in this, on this continent, as received in the body of a young woman, who is in touch with something really big.
Yeah. Bigger than even imaginable. And I think when you're able to read this, I think you will understand what Tracy is talking about and what we've been discussing the last 45 minutes. I don't think there's enough words to describe the importance of this memoir. I don't think there's enough, there's history here, there's storytelling, there's a life well lived, and there's no judgment. There's a simple, beautiful telling of a family story that's rooted in so much power and survival, and the fact that they're here, right? That's the word. We're still here, Lou. So I'm going to go to a couple of questions that came through here. One of the first ones is from Tammy Reston. So Tracy, first of all, thank you so much. And I'll thank you more in the end. This is not even an assignment. This is joy. This is, we're talking about Sister Lucille with someone whom I admire very much. Tammy would like to know, would you talk about how Clifton uses poetic techniques in Generations? And she says, thank you. This is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, that's a great question. I feel like every bit of her prose feels like it has the compression and the intention of poetry running through it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I read that paragraph that felt to me like a small play, mm-hmm. that allowed you to see something sort of central to the nature of history and the nature of power in this country and the lie that props it up. She also does really amazing things with time. And so this is a memoir that's written episodically. There'll be a person who marks a generation, and then there'll be like a few sections that sit beneath that person's name. And what I love is that in some ways her father's voice helps us to move in and out of time. The present tense of this book is going to the funeral to bury Clifton's father.
Yes.
And that is a story that runs through the book, but it's punctuated by the moments when his voice comes back to her, and she's in the presence not only of him, but these other family members who he brings to life for her. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a way of leaping around through time in the book. That feels very poetic to me, the way that a poem can lift off from one place and take you to the other place that's not chronologically connected, but mm-hmm. that's psychically or thematically relevant to where we are. That happens. What else? What would you add to that, Tripita? Because this feels
I think the rhythm, you had mentioned it in your introduction. It's the rhythm, and she does it even in her short poems and all of her works that she has. To me, this read very much like poetry, mm-hmm. visual, the imagery. These were the things that carried me through the story. You mentioned about the ride and them cackling and laughing through the ignorance on this road. And I'm seeing a poem unfold on that road. I'm seeing the look on the woman's face. So I think imagery, the language, the movement, the rhythm of these, all those things are the poetic techniques that I think she used really well. Mm-hmm. There's a prayer, there's a song-like characteristics to some of the writing. I don't think that she says, I think she used herself to write these poems, mm-hmm. to write this memoir. And what she is a genius and a poet. And I love that you said genius, because her grandmother called her that all the time, you know, and I felt, you know, really, warned by that someone called her a genius like that, and as a young woman. Mm-hmm. So CK Tasman wanted to know, she says, Tracy, I've read you study with Lucille Clifton. Would you talk about how her writing influences yours, and maybe a favorite story and or word of wisdom about writing from Lucille Clifton with gratitude?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I feel so fortunate. Oh, I studied with Lucille Clifton my first semester as a grad student at Columbia in the MFA program. And I was, you know, 23 and largely lost. Mm-hmm. I was also still in grief. My mother had passed the year before. And so I was, you know, hoping that this would help me to keep moving forward in life. And I got into her workshop, and one of the first things I remember her doing was being really honest about the deaths that she had been shaped by, her husband, a child, and her mother. And she talked about how she had conversations with these people. And the same meditative space in which a poem can emerge for her was a space where listening and dialogue became possible. And I felt like, I don't know how I will ever do that, but this is what I want to do somehow. I want to learn how to do that. I want to learn how to be in the world in the way that Lucille Clifton is. Be living without fear and in touch with these other layers of reality. She told us stories about conversations that she had with the ones, with these non-human spirit voices who had insistent messages. And some of that comes out in her poems, The Light That Came to Lucille Clifton. And then she published a sequence that feels to me, having heard those stories, like transcriptions or distillations of those encounters in the last book she published, Mercy, under the title, The Message from the Ones, received in the late 1970s. Mm-hmm. And those are messages for mankind that actually are messages for mankind and are actually overwhelming poems.
But I can see the influences even in your work on it was Duende, and these different themes that have, well, I wouldn't say influences necessarily, but there's certainly a connection, you know, this in that spiritual realm, in that idea that, you know, there are forces larger or different than ourselves that present themselves in our lives and in our writing. Mm-hmm. So I can definitely feel that. And someone's asking a question about Toni Morrison's friendship to Clifton and her career. Now, we know that Toni Morrison, as a prolific of a writer and a genius of a writer as Toni Morrison was, is, we also know that she published and made it possible for a lot of African-American writers, particularly women writers, to be published and to become published and open the doors for them when she was an editor. So someone's asking about the importance of friendship, her friendship with Clifton. Do you have any information about that you want to share?
Well, Toni Morrison wrote the introduction for the collected poems of Lucille Clifton, which came, it's her work from 1965 to 2010. And so she talks about working with her. I believe, did she edit this book? I should know that.
She did, I believe so, yes.
Yeah,
so she talks about that. Yes.
She also talks about the frustration that she feels or felt at the way that Clifton was often described by other poets who didn't acknowledge and maybe weren't equipped to see because of what they might have been looking for in poems about Black life and that often adopt the Black vernacular, didn't see the deep, searing intelligence and critique that runs through those poems. You know, the way that you might put a bubble around something and say, oh, that's about them. Mm-hmm. When in reality, you're right there. You're right at the center of it. And so she talks about that. It's a really, I think it's a really useful essay because of the way that it talks about that editorial relationship and then also this ongoing sense of the enduring value of this work and how it has been misread in many ways.
Yeah, I really appreciate Toni Morrison for that. And I appreciate that sisterhood in a sense, because I do think there were times in Lucille Clifton's career where I don't think her value, her contribution as a writer had really been, had really been put out there. Only like, I would say recent years that many people have kind of taken it on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree with Morrison. And then as we kind of move into our last questions, Mindy Shapiro is writing, just she went to high school with two of Clifton's daughters, Frederica, who died young, and Sydney, who was a few years older. And she remembers Lucille coming, she said, I remember Lucille coming to my high school to read. It always left an impression. I was thrilled to learn that Sydney raised funds to buy back the family home to open a residency for African-American writers. So what impact do you think this will have on her legacy? And I want to just tell the audience that is that Writer's House is located in Baltimore. And it's a whole story around that we don't have a lot of time to tell, but I want
that was my question for you in a way. Maybe I can tie it into this.
Yes.
Because you have written about this reacquisition of this house. And yes, I wanted to know, and you spoke with some of Clifton's children. I wanted to know how that connects back to you to this story, how that experience, her legacy essentially connects back or inflects your reading of generations, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yes, no. So for me, it adds another layer. I am really a serious, I don't want to say student. I think it's, I believe that as Black writers, as Black women writers, I really do believe that when we have the ability to shine a light and to continue to lift up, to help, I don't want to say carry a legacy, but tow part of it to wherever you need to tow, I think that's essential. So for me, it's major. The story around her daughter, I just only had an opportunity to learn about the house. And this house was purchased back. It was actually lost in foreclosure many years ago when Lucille Clifton was still with her husband. And her daughter, I read, works for the Jim Henson Puppet Company. And she was able to buy back this family home. Now, this all happened right as the pandemic began, but her hope. So for me, the impact to be able to be among her things is one of my favorite phrases that I use a lot for a writer. These things, what are they going to, what are the choices that are involved with what you show about a writer's life, what you choose the public to see? Because a lot of our lifestyles are so internal. Right. So yeah. What do you, what do you choose for people to see? So I think it's major. I think this book, I really encourage, I know Andy put the information in the chat. I really encourage people to get this book. Really, if you are someone who appreciates poetry, if you appreciate the work of Lucille Clifton and Tracy K. Smith, I really encourage you to get this book, because we're talking about legacy here, and it's here, and it comes in many forms. So we're about to close. So Tracy, thank you. Any last words, anything you want to add? It's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise. I would say this book teaches me something about holding what I descend from and what I claim. You know, it teaches me something about holding it and using it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a real gift.
Yes. Thank you so much. I'm seeing something in here. And your gift, your love of Lucille Clifton, and to be able to share with the rest of us through your writings, just amazing. So thank you, everyone. Ed is saying wonderful talk. Have a wonderful evening, everyone, and stay safe. And get the book, Generations, Lucille Clifton, Introduction by Tracy K. Smith. Have a wonderful evening. Tracy, thank you. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.